short break and then have some questions?
Oh, that'd be good, yeah.
Okay, let's do that. 10 minutes. Yeah, I'm curious about a little bit of your backstory that you do for Davis. Okay, you just kind of like dropped it in on us. And I'm wondering when you were in the hospitality of the penal system, if that's where you found your voice then? Like, is that where you started to determine that this is really something I'm liking, this is where I want to go? And then when you finally walked out, did you have an idea or a path on how to achieve that?
Yes, I did. What happened, I was in, I kind of thought I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't know exactly what it meant. And at school I was good at memorizing long poems, like Tennyson's poems. I memorized a poem called The Revenge, which I used to recite when I was in solitary confinement. it was about this Englishman who sunk the Spanish fleet as they sailed across the English Channel. And it's a long, like, ballad. And but I had this ability to do this at school. It's about all I could do, and I would recite them and go on the radio as a 12-year-old or 11-year-old and win Estedfords and things like that for my amazing feats of memory. But I loved the poems, and I loved The Highwayman, which is another thing I had in common with Robert Creeley. I didn't think real poets liked poems like that. And I read in one of Creeley's lectures somewhere that he liked The Highwayman. And together, when we got drunk, we would recite The Highwayman. And it was really terrified people. but it's a lovely poem. Not the way we recited it. But I was... So I didn't really think I would write. I used to draw. And I used to paint, but my parents didn't encourage me to do anything in the arts because they didn't think I would be able to, you know, they're working class people, and they thought it'd be better getting a trade, which I got a trade as a pastry cook for a while. But when I was in Long Bay Prison, around about the time of that poem, my 21st birthday, I was in the exercise yard and pacing up and down with these other guys. And the authorities had just installed speakers into the canyons of the cell blocks, and they were mainly to issue instructions to, if there was a riot and things, you know, stop or shoot or whatever. And but there was one officer who was a bit, he might have been drinking, I don't know, but he put the radio on. And it came through, we hadn't heard it for months and months. And it came through these speakers, and there was this disc jockey at Sydney called John Laws, who was a reactionary guy who, like, kind of when Ronald Reagan came into power, he loved him. So, you know, sort of, he used to play Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin kind of songs. And he sort of had to play the top 10. And Peter, Paul and Mary had a song called Blowing in the Wind. Mm-hmm. And he said, you would never know this quite good song was written by this dreadful reactionary person, Bob Dylan. And he played the song that says, a bullet from the back of a bush took Meg Ever's life. And I heard his voice, and I was just electrified by it. I thought, this is it, whatever this is, it's it. This is great. And I went back to my cell and told my friends or my fellow inmates, it wasn't that great. They said, that was garbage. That was disgusting. He's right. He can't sing. It's terrible. What is he talking about? What are you? You've gone mad. You know, we knew you were mad. And I went around. I couldn't find anyone that liked it. They hated it. When I went home, I bought Blonde on Blonde and played it to my mother, and she said, you'll go back to prison if you keep playing that. So I started to, when I was in prison, I started writing songs. And I showed them to a Jesuit priest. And he came back 2 weeks later, because I asked him, could you get me a guitar? He came back 2 weeks later and said, I'm sorry to tell you, these aren't songs. I said, right, that'd be right. He said, they're poems. And I thought, oh, that's just what I need in here. I don't think they'll go down too well. I won't tell anyone. He gave me a copy of Gerard Manley Hopkins. And I'd been reading Shelley and T.S. Eliot, which I got from the library. And I thought Hopkins was more modern. I didn't know where they when they were lived. And I thought Hopkins must be just new. He must be the latest. And Eliot would have been maybe 50 years before Hopkins. And, you know, sort of. And I just couldn't stop reading Hopkins and started doing imitations. Then I saw a book in the library by Dylan Thomas, and I thought, oh, he's probably stolen his name from Bob Dylan. And I took that book out, and I loved that. I was all mixed up, but it did me good. And then, from then on, I just looked on the back of Bob Dylan's records and followed up everybody he mentioned. Rambo was one, so I went and bought that and bought Enid Starkey's Life. And then I went to a... I'd been out of prison for about a month. I saved up and bought a typewriter. I worked in a factory, spot welding desks or something terrible. I bought a typewriter, and then I took my poems into a workshop at Sydney University, where there are other poets. In those days, they put the poem in an epidioscope, a thing called an epidioscope, and it shot the poems onto the blackboard, and we'd go through it line by line. And we basically tear each other's poems apart. The Sydney University poets in 1970 came out of a school that was probably, Leavis was one of the people behind it, this fierce critic from Cambridge and also a Marxist factor. And so it had to be for the good of humanity or word by word. And so it was pretty pessimistic sort of reading. You basically tore each other apart, but it did us a lot of good. And... eventually, you know, I sent poems to a magazine, and they got published, and I started writing to a Jesuit magazine, and my first published poem was about St. Augustine. Yeah, and that was because of Bob Dylan's song, I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine, which I used to love quoting because it was taken from I Dreamed I Saw Joe Hill, the union leader, which would drive my friends crazy because they were pretty much Marxists. And so Dylan kept hitting the right note all along until I came across I met Allen Ginsberg, and he gave me Robert Duncan's address, and I wrote to him, and then I found all these wonderful poets in America, which, because in England the poetry is pretty bleak and ordinary and not that good really. And overall, I mean, Geoffrey Hill is a great he's an exception. There's not a lot of exceptions. It was especially during the 50s. Is this all being recorded? 50s and 60s. it's what I think. And they didn't write about sex. I mean, Philip Larkin, you know, God almighty. It's very miserable. Philip Larkin's brilliant technically, and it's a joy to read how well he can string words together. But what he's saying is pretty abysmal and nasty, in fact. And Eliot got worse. He just destroyed Shelley for about 5 generations, as Michael Palmer's essay described. That's a wonderful essay, that one of yours. But, you know, so in that atmosphere, I didn't know about American poetry that much. When I read Ginsberg, I didn't really like it. I didn't think it was as good as Dylan. I thought Desolation Row was much better than Howl. I thought it was more disciplined and more contained. And it was basically... like that Ashbery line, the Academy of the Future is opening its doors, and it was named America. Once I got Donald Allen's anthology, The New American Poetry, it just changed what was possible. And I started being influenced by the poems in that and spreading it around, going to giving lectures and talking about it and promoting it and making... I ran a poetry magazine, and if any poet sent poems to my magazine, I would write them a rejection slip saying, if you get Donald Allen's anthology, The New American Poetry, I'll read your poems. If you don't get it and read it, I won't read them. a lot of Australian poets, hundreds of them, read that book and change, but, you know, it drifts back and forth between England and America, depending on the political atmosphere. If things are bleak, you go back to this bleak sort of pessimistic sort of English kind of view of things, where it's, I mean, as far as England and America, the best summation of America to me comes in a line from Leonard Cohen, where he says, "America is the cradle of the best and the worst." And to get that, you know, you've got to have the worst before you get the poets being that good. You know, you've got to have a lot on your mind, a lot of bad things on your mind. Yeah, as well as the beauty, yeah, yeah.
Did you happen to meet Dylan then, or is he aware of how he actually influenced you?
Well, when I wrote my autobiography, one of my best friends knew him pretty well, Brett Whiteley, a painter, he gave him, and I quoted about maybe 15 lines of Dylan, and if you do that in a publication, he's a company tracks you down and charges you like $500 a line or something. I sent it to my publisher and they said, "You can't have the Bob Dylan lines in." And I said, "Why not? Just write to..." And I told them the guy's name to write to and send him a copy. And they wrote back and said, "It's fine, you can have them." So, you know. And I did dedicate the book to Dylan. But I got the chance to meet him once, and I was so nervous. I drank a bottle of Jack Daniels and yeah, it was a press conference with my friend in his studio and on television, and I sat in the corner and hid, basically. what can you say? It's not like meeting a poet. I met Ginsberg in a hotel room after a poetry festival, and there were six or seven other poets, and he wanted to talk to poets. Well, Dylan said to this reporter, London Times guy, said to him, "You said you're a poet, you know, are you a poet or not?" And he said, Dylan said, "Oh, what do you keep asking me that for?" And he said, "Well, you know, people say you're a poet, and you've said you're a poet." And Dylan said, "No, I said I was a tightrope walker." And he said, they kept persisting. And Dylan said, "Listen, I don't call myself a poet. Have you ever met those guys?" So you don't really need... He's not really... I mean, if you met him when you were going fishing or something, you know, or doing something, I don't know. I don't know what it means anymore. His fame is just so big, and... yeah. But you can meet very famous poets really easily, so I don't know what the difference would be.
Money.
Yeah, money? Yeah. We met Seamus Heaney really easily. We took him to an oyster bar, and... Yeah, this... Usually if you write to anyone you admire and read their work thoroughly and write a letter saying, "I've read your work," and you indicate that by a few paragraphs, you know, of understanding of their work, they write back to you, and after a while you get to meet them. When you get a good letter, and I say to my students, don't send emails, write letters, because it comes... I'll never forget when I got a letter from Robert Duncan. It was on this beautiful paper, written in a fountain pen, in this beautiful ink, in copper plate writing. And you just look at it for 10 minutes before you even open it, and then you read it 1,000 times. And it's just got this emblematic sort of magic to it. And it's even more these days, even more so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a stamp.
I'm wondering about, as you revealed today in your reading, like, this love for birds is very pervasive and goes back to your childhood, really. And I'm wondering what, as a poet, you think you get from the birds?
Well, so when I was really tiny, maybe five or four, I wanted to be an ornithologist. I didn't know what that word was. I wanted to have a job that had to do with birds. And, my first memory really was to get a falcon, that I would have a falcon. And then when I looked for my first job I went to, because I was expelled from school. I didn't have a leaving certificate, which was a high school certificate. I went to the zoo and asked for a job there, cleaning the cages in the bird, and they said, no, you have to have a school certificate to do it to work. I said, for cleaning shit? They said, yes, you do. And so I really wanted to be an ornithologist. So what's happened really, I've become a poet of birds instead of... And what it is about them is, they're like sort of angels or something, you know, they're beautiful and they sing. In Australia, the birds sing really loudly. I noticed here the birds are much softer, but there's a reason for that. There's a new book called Where Song Came From, written by this brilliant scientist who is a great writer as well in Australia, Where Song Came From, and he has just, it's been published in the scientific journals that the first songbirds came from Australia and spread throughout the world. The lyrebird doesn't have a tongue, it has a really old, it hasn't evolved since the prehistoric days. It's basically a prehistoric bird, and the birds in Australia have to sing for all these different reasons, the harsher land, harsher times. The whole book it's like a PhD thesis that explains these differences, and that songbirds in England are really mild compared to our birds. The songs of the Australian birds are extraordinary. Butcher birds sing like jazz players, Charles Parker said, bird, Charlie Parker, isn't it? He said, a critic said to him, do you take critics seriously? He said, I take critics about as seriously as an ornithologist takes, as a bird would take an ornithologist. there's a poem by Seamus Heaney called St. Kevin and the Blackbird, which really gets why I love birds. It's some replacement for some religious instinct or something like that as well. But I just love it. When I see a bird, it just makes me feel happy, and it makes me feel to keep going to see the next one. The first thing I did when I come to America is look for what birds and where they are and how different they are. And they're just like muses to me. I just love them. I don't know whether I really want to go too much closer to that. I think it's a failure that I couldn't have been a scientist or an ornithologist, so I've ended up putting it into poetry. Yeah, probably that. There's lots of complex reasons, but I should write an essay about it one day. I will.
I was kind of curious just if you ever get stuck in a poem or kind of blocked, if there's anything in particular you do to get unblocked.
What do I do to get unblocked? Yeah. I read other poets. You just find a new book or a book that you remember that you loved once, and you read it again. And often read Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and often read it out. If you read out the Ballad of the Ancient Mariner to yourself or to your friends, it's incredible. And you get to the parts in it where there's one line that says that he's in the boat and looking at this crazy character who's rowing the boy and the wedding guest, and the wedding guest says, "I realized the devil knows how to row." And you think, wow, that's so good. He's rowing away from the boat, but just flashes of lines that come out, that would inspire a poem. You just look for lines sometimes. I often read Geoffrey Hill, who is quite a difficult poet, but he's got the most startling lines. And I love music. a new Emmy Lou Harris album's enough to get me going again, or a new Bob Dylan record, whatever, Van Morrison. I'm not so inspired by music without lyrics. It's the lyrics that I love. Yeah. And also, I think if you're blocked on a poem, there's nothing to do but put it away and start another one. And usually you go back to it maybe a month later and you think, oh, did I write that? That's not as bad as I thought. And you just keep going. And every time you see a word, you think, that's pretty ordinary, that word. I'll change that to a better word. And you find a better word, then you have to change the whole poem. And you keep going and just improve. You think of it line by line, or word by word if possible. But if you look at Zhukovsky's thin poems and see how beautiful they are, or how... You admire it so much, it inspires you. Reading is the answer, yeah. Reading poetry is more important, I think, than writing poetry. When you read enough and get to love it and know it deeply, Robert Duncan said this wonderful thing to me, that if you are a poet, and not all of us are poets, you become a link in this chain of poets that goes from the beginning of time, or before the beginning of time, until the end of time. And once you become a link, you will be able to write. And to do that, you have to know all those traditions and all those poems. And the more you saturate yourself in the world of poetry, in the imagination, as Wallace Stevens says, the imagination, the one reality in this imagined world, then you're into it. You're off. I hope that helps.
So you talked about sort of the beginning of that link of chains. I noticed you evoking, like, you know, Spinoza and St. Augustine. Is that more recent, or when did you get work your way, I guess, back to that?
I didn't get back to it, no. Is that what you are? I missed the beginning of your question. Sorry, I'm a bit deaf.
Oh, sorry. No, I'm just wondering what you took from those guys, or how you got that far back to St. Augustine and Spinoza. What
you take from that? Well, it was simple. As I said, I heard Bob Dylan's song, I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine Alive As You Or Me. And the line where he says, I put my fingers to the glass and bowed my head and cried. The Dylan dreamt that he was one of the people that put Augustine out to die. But really, it was the Union leader, Joe Hill, that the song was originally written about. But to me it was... So I, because of that reference, I went and bought the Penguin Confessions of St. Augustine, and I thought it'd be really difficult. It was so easy to read. It's like Thoreau, it's just easy. It's just this story of this crazy guy that does... This brilliant guy who doesn't... Sometimes he doesn't really believe in God. He keeps saying, Dear Lord, forgive me for saying this, but... And then he goes on for 20 pages about something and said, only a wretched sinner like me would think these things. And I really liked his attitude. And it taught me how to write an autobiography. Spinoza, I've always... noticed, I read him when I was in prison. There was a series called The Great Books of the Western World that was put out by Encyclopedia Britannia. And when I first saw it, I just liked the word Spinoza. I thought, that sounds great. And I started reading that. And it's really about, it's a bit like Wallace Stevens in that sense that there's God, there's no real God, but we are God, that nature is some, that we can create ourselves through being, that we are holy in the sense that life is. Pantheism of a form, of a sophisticated, very sophisticated order, yeah. And that was very appealing and reassuring to me. Yeah. Wonderful questions. It makes it easy.
Where else are you going in your travels?
Well, we're going to St. Louis to a writer in residency with, and my wife's going to give some lectures there too, Juno, on photography. 2 weeks there, and then to Chicago to the Poetry Foundation to do a reading there, and then to Maine, Woodland Patton in Milwaukee, and we'll go and see. I'm going to go to Snake Island where Laurie Nerdecker. I'm going to see her house, and that'll be good. And then to Maine to see Steve Evans and Jennifer Moxley, and
Princeton,
yeah. I don't know how I got there, but Devin Johnson organized and sent them my book, I think. Yeah, me and Devin will be going to Princeton together and doing a joint reading there, yeah. Yeah.
Devin's the publisher of Flood Editions.
He's also a great poet. He's a really good poet.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure.